This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
As the coronavirus spreads across America, we're asking, how does immunity work? And as U.S. states shut things down again, English pubs are reopening, with bar owners keeping expectations low.
No, we're not going to make profit. I mean, at the moment, my ambition is just to make a positive contribution towards rent.
And when the bars open tomorrow at 6 in the morning, the English will behave sensibly, right?
Unlikely, to be honest.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, new music from the National Band of Djibouti. The musicians lead double lives.
When they're off duty, they're off work, and they're sitting and hanging around and jamming, they are not playing national ceremony music.
They know how to march in formation, and they know how to swing. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here on the start of this holiday weekend. Typically, heading into July 4th, a lot of us would be on the road already. But if there's been one realization this week, it's that this pandemic is going to be with us for a while. SARS-CoV-2, that's the scientific name for the novel coronavirus. It's already changed America and the world in so many profound ways, and yet the disease is still cloaked in a lot of mystery. Front and center in this puzzle, understanding immunity and how it works. As scientists around the globe collect even more clues, the answers are not so straightforward, at least not yet, as the world's Ilana Gordon explains.
Sydney Ramirez was already into coronaviruses before the pandemic. Her inspiration came from her dad, a doctor. He wound up caring for people who came down with the original SARS back in 2003 when he was traveling with a group in China.
He told me those stories and I knew that I wanted to do infectious disease research. I knew that I wanted to work in a virology lab.
Ramirez is now a doctor herself and a virologist in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Global Public Health at the University of California, San Diego, and the nearby La Jolla Institute for Immunology. When this new coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, emerged in January, she was ready to jump in.
One of the important questions that we were trying to figure out is what sort of immunity is protective for SARS-CoV-2.
So what mechanisms in the body can successfully fight off this virus, and what backfires?
When I think about immunity, I kind of think about warfare, unfortunately. And the fact that, like, there's always this arms race where the virus is trying to make, you know, better weapons, and then the body is trying to make better weapons. And it's sort of a matter of, like, who wins.
Scientists have learned that SARS-CoV-2 has a particular way of invading our cells. The virus has a spike-shaped protein on its shell. Ramirez says, think of that spike as a special key that can then unlock the doors to our cells.
So basically, once it's inside the cell, it hijacks the factory and starts pumping out, you know, various pieces of itself and makes more virus and more virus and more virus. And usually what happens is it makes so much virus that it ends up killing the cell.
Our bodies have different weapons and strategies on reserve to try and stop this takeover. Some act as the general first responder to any kind of infection.
It's kind of a blunt instrument, so it kind of doesn't know the difference between different viruses.
Others are more targeted and learn to adapt to a specific virus. Think of these as the special forces units. They can include certain antibody proteins that can neutralize a certain virus, or T cells. Different types of T cells can coordinate an attack on a specific virus, or even kill it. Ramirez began searching for clues to how these responses play out against SARS-CoV-2 in the blood samples of a handful of patients, patients who had been infected and recovered from mild cases of the disease.
Part of what we saw that was really great is that we saw people made good immune responses, both antibody responses and T-cell responses to the spike protein. And the reason I say that this is, you know, good news is the fact that the spike protein is the main part of the virus that the vaccines out there are targeting.
Looking at immune responses in the lab has limitations. These are also small sample sizes.
So it gave us the first steps.
These first steps are launching scientists on a windy journey, because here are some of the twists already. Some people don't generate a strong antibody response, but still seem to survive coronavirus just fine. Ramirez saw in all the samples she studied that the virus activated certain T cell responses. Could this be a clue that this branch of our body's special forces leads the successful attack?
I don't think it's black and white.
Rory de Vries researches immunology at Erasmus Medical Center in the Netherlands. De Vries has been following patients long-term and recently worked on a study of samples from patients who were really sick with COVID-19, the disease caused by SARS-CoV-2. Some died. He saw those T-cell immune responses in the lab from those samples, too.
So that is what we have learned there majorly. So it means that these T-cells can be protective. But it could also be some kind of clue that these T cells maybe play a role in actually making disease worse. At this stage, we just don't know yet. That is certainly one of the topics that we need to study further.
Sometimes these special forces can overreact. Sometimes their effectiveness depends on timing, as in how quickly and robustly they can mobilize as the virus takes hold. De Vries, Ramirez, and others are also looking for clues about how previous exposures to other coronaviruses, like the common cold, might boost the immune response to SARS-CoV-2. Dr. Susie Dunahy now co-runs an immunology lab on COVID-19 at the University of Oxford in the UK. Her work is independent from the Oxford vaccine trial.
I have been humbled so many times about this virus, and so many things about this virus have been surprising.
Dunahy also thinks T cells could be really important in building up a protective immunity. But why some people get sick and others don't could depend on lots of other factors, too. Factors that are specific to what's happening in the immune responses at the site of infection, like the lungs, or the site of exposure, like the nose.
And it might be that the other germs up your nose, that's the microbiome, so other bacteria and viruses that live harmlessly up there, they might have an impact on whether this particular virus takes a hold.
Researchers are also looking for clues to immunity in age differences. What's different about kids' immune responses compared to adults? In all these efforts, the big looming question is, when people do get COVID-19 and recover, how long will they stay immune to the disease?
The next thing to find out is whether people get significant infection again, and we need to wait and see.
Still, Dunahy and others say all these clues they're collecting about immunity right now are really important. They can help better shape treatments, vaccine development, and the overall public health response. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Red light, green light. Those are the signals coming out of London today. England will be giving the go-ahead to travelers who want to visit from more than 50 countries and territories. Scotland and Wales, however, have yet to decide on a green or red light. They're skeptical, though, about the timing of this move. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was in the hot seat at LBC, a call-in radio show.
I think that it's right that we should open up cautiously.
So here's the deal. People traveling to England from 59 different countries and territories will no longer have to go into quarantine for 2 weeks when they arrive. Places on the green light list include Germany, Spain, France, and Italy, as well as Turkey, Japan, and Vietnam. But it's a red light for other places, including the United States.
We've made a huge effort as a country to get this virus under control. We cannot have reinfection from abroad.
Overall, this marks a big shift. For the last month, anyone coming into the UK, even citizens, were required to go into isolation for 14 days. The change takes effect in a week on July 10th. Britain's Transportation Secretary Grant Shapps talked about it on the BBC this morning.
It does mean that people have the opportunity perhaps to still get a summer holiday in, but I'm not going to pretend it's been an easy process.
Just because England is giving the green light to travelers from certain countries does not mean those countries' governments are offering the same. For example, Englanders looking to vacation in France, they're looking at a yellow light and will be advised to quarantine. Want to go to New Zealand? Nice try. That country is not allowing anybody in. One more thing you can do in England soon, go to the bar. English pubs will reopen tomorrow after almost 4 months of lockdown. Police are urging people to be calm and be sensible. but with bars opening at 6 in the morning tomorrow for an occasion that's been dubbed Super Saturday, it's not clear that restrained behavior is on tap, shall we say. Gareth Kerr is owner of Cafe Kick, a pub in Clerkenwell in London. Do you think people are going to be common-sensible when you open your doors tomorrow?
Unlikely, to be honest.
Really? So why are you opening? I mean, it's a hazardous time.
It is a hazardous time. I mean, I think that obviously they've got to do stepping stones. I think Saturday, in hindsight, probably wasn't the wisest day for the opening. But yeah, I mean, we've sort of put lots and lots of steps in place. You know, obviously the public have got to be smart and they have to social distance themselves and they've got to be self-reliant. And so I'm hoping, and everyone's hoping, that people are sensible and realize that we don't want a second spike. But you never know.
Well, how have you actually been preparing for tomorrow? Like tables further apart, bar stools further apart, that kind of thing?
Everything. I mean, for example, with sport, when we show live sport, we have to show it with very low sound so that people don't shout. We have table football machines in our bar, so we
give people face masks
because they, in case that, you know, for people shouting, it's everything socially distanced, all the furniture socially distanced. So I just think that Saturday will be the odd day. I think everyone's going to go mad on tomorrow, and then I think it'll calm down and it'll become sensible and as it should have been and how the government probably intended it to be.
How many people will you allow into your bar at once, and how are you going to keep tabs on that?
Yeah, well, we're going to manage it from the front. So when people come in, we've put a bar favela bar at the entrance. So we're going to serve from that bar. We serve straight to the street, but we also control the entry system. We have to take their name and details for track and trace. And then we just usher them to the table. They're not allowed to stand at the bar. We've considered it a lot. I mean, I've had 3 months to think about it. So, you know, we're ready for it.
That detail you just mentioned, though, that you'll have to take contact details of all the customers so officials can contact trace them in the event of somebody testing positive. Are you going to do that?
Yeah, we have to. Yeah. No, that's all part of the guidance. Yeah.
I mean, that's going to make a very different pub experience, I imagine.
It is going to be a different experience. But the public have to understand that this is a different time. And in order for them to be given, you know, this freedom, it comes with conditions.
So a lot of pubs in England decided not to reopen tomorrow. They felt it was too soon. And also, it's, you know, it's their choice. You decided to go ahead. Are you nervous about the decision?
I'm not that nervous because I put a lot of thought into it. We're lucky geographically the way my bar is. We were on a market street. It's a pedestrian street. It's a one entrance bar. We're able to control very, very well internally. And then externally, we've got a bit of extra security. You know, we're going to do it as well as anyone would do it.
Gareth, you're a businessman. Can you make a profit given that the numbers you can have in your bar will be limited?
No chance. No, we're not going to make profit. I mean, at the moment, my ambition is just to make a positive contribution towards rent. So if I can cover the staff cost and make any form of contribution towards rent, I'm in a better position than I was the day before yesterday.
It really is a different time. I saw that there were police officers attacked in London last week after trying to break up an unlawful gathering. Are you concerned these openings could start and then there's a new surge and then you'll be shut again?
Yeah, that's definitely. I mean, a Saturday is not a clever day to start it. But yeah, I mean, that absolutely is possible. I mean, I'm very experienced in what I do in terms of, you know, the environment I work in. So I'll control it as well as I can. And I see trouble before trouble happens. So it's just being aware and being very hyper vigilant on in terms of everything. So I'm hoping it goes issueless.
Spoken like a good publican.
Yeah, exactly.
Gareth Kerr, owner of Cafe Kick, a pub in Clerkenwell in London. Good luck tomorrow. I'm glad you'll be able to at least have a taste of the good old days.
Thank you very, very much.
The pandemic has been stressful. Even people lucky enough to keep their jobs through all this have been feeling the pressure. That's why a town in Nova Scotia decided to try something kind of radical to improve the work-life balance.
They were able to deal with those challenges a little bit easier, and they seem to be happier at work.
The story of that pandemic workplace experiment just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For many of you, today is the start of a 3-day weekend, but what if that were the case every weekend? Sounds almost too utopian to be true. The four-day work week has been talked about for decades, but never really caught on. The coronavirus pandemic, however, is getting a lot of people to rethink the way they work. One municipality in northeastern Canada has even started to test out the four-day work week. Anita Elash has the story.
Guysborough County is on the northeastern side of Nova Scotia. It's a rural area with a population of about 5,000. Municipal employees have always worked the traditional Monday to Friday, five-day week, but that changed when the coronavirus lockdown began in March.
Everybody was dealing with added stresses because of COVID.
Barry Carroll is the CEO of municipal government in Guysborough. In order to keep essential workers healthy, he says the municipality decided to be flexible about time off.
They were able to deal with those challenges a little bit easier, and they seemed to be happier at work.
Carroll says the staff didn't miss a beat. He put that down to a better work-life balance. So when the municipality reopened a couple of weeks ago, it ditched tradition and the new four-day week became official.
People do have a bounce in their step. They're pretty happy having that extra day off.
That's no surprise to Erica Carlton, who studies organizational behavior at the University of Saskatchewan.
There's a theory called the happy productive worker hypothesis.
According to that theory, happier workers are more productive workers. And one thing that makes them happy is working 4 days per week.
They have more time away from work to recover from work, so that when they go back to work, they actually are better at doing their jobs.
Companies around the world have tested and proven this idea. Just last year, Microsoft Japan tried out a 4 day work week for the entire month of August. They found that workers were nearly 40% more productive. British companies that have tried it say most of their staff was less stressed and took fewer sick days. But the four-day week has never really been taken all that seriously. And until the pandemic happened, Graham Barlow thought he understood why.
It does present a lot of scheduling challenges and kind of generally fear.
Barlow is the chief executive of a tech company based in Ottawa called Iversoft. It's about to start testing its own version of a four-day work week. When the idea came up, Barlow says his first thought was,
what happens if a crisis comes up? What happens if you need to be on call?
But when Barlow's team crunched the data, they found these sorts of crises almost never happen. Now employees will work remotely at least until next January. And starting next week, he says the office will be closed on Fridays.
There's some weird psychological barriers that people need to try and break through, that we have an opportunity right now to rethink work and rethink how companies are run and organized.
In Guysborough, Nova Scotia, other employers in the area are keeping a close eye on the municipality's four-day workweek experiment. Ingrid Nickerson runs the local co-op.
Yeah, I hear them talking about it on the news, and I think, how could we do that here at the grocery store?
She says she's not sure if it could work, but she can see the benefits. Her husband, a mechanic at a nearby quarry, recently convinced his boss to let him work a compressed four-day week.
You know, if you're a homeowner, there's always stuff to do. There's always lawn to be mowed. And then he's home to cook my supper, too, at least two nights a week that I'm working. So that's a win-win.
Guysborough's CEO, Barry Carroll, tells me it's probably time to do things a little differently. After the four-day workweek pilot project gets going, he's planning to bring in a team to assess if his staff is both healthier and more productive. For The World, I'm Anita Elash.
A landslide at a jade mine in northern Myanmar has killed at least 170 people, with more feared dead. Search and rescue efforts continued for a second day today. Authorities say a pile of mine waste slid into a lake after heavy rains. That sent a wave of mud and water that buried dozens of people.
La 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 la.
In a video from the scene, a greenish wave of water floods down a hillside into a valley below. Workers who are not visible in the frame are further down the hillside, fleeing for their lives. Paul Donowitz is with Global Witness, an environmental and human rights advocacy group. He joins us from Washington. It's jaw-dropping, this video, Paul. It's hard to tell, but this lake seems really big, and the waves that resulted from this hillside of waste are enormous. It's scary to watch what happened. How common are these incidents?
Unfortunately, all too common. We've seen these types of incidents happen over the last several years with scores of miners dying as a result.
My understanding is that the situation in this case is even worse than artisanal mining. These were informal workers scavenging the mining waste left behind by a larger mining company. Can you explain how this all works?
So mining companies are granted licenses to operate mines. And what happens is, as they are digging out the stone where the jade is located, they're dumping the waste into these huge piles, which build and build and build into mountains of waste. Then you have tens to hundreds of thousands of people, informal miners. They're known locally as Yamasei. Now, these informal miners are often mining in very perilous conditions with no protection, and these rock piles can become unstable, and incidents like today will then happen.
The leader of Myanmar's government, Aung San Suu Kyi, pledged to clean up the industry when she assumed power back in 2016. What is Myanmar's government doing to regulate these mining operations, and what's changed since Aung San Suu Kyi made that pledge?
Well, when the NLD government took power, the first thing that they did to address these issues was to suspend the issuances of new licenses or the extension of existing licenses in an attempt to gain control over the sector and to begin a reform process. Unfortunately, the fundamental problem in the jade mining area is that there is no rule of law. The area is controlled by armed groups, both the Myanmar military as well as powerful ethnic armed groups and government-backed militias are all extorting miners, illegally taxing. You really have a lawless situation that, despite the government's efforts to reform the regulatory framework, have not addressed some of the fundamental issues.
Yeah, Aung San Suu Kyi commented on this disaster, and she says joblessness is to blame. But doesn't sound like this is a new development, as she's implying, is it?
We have seen an increase in dangerous mining practices since the licensing suspension. One of the prime reasons being that as licenses are set to expire, companies are mining as fast as possible. Or when their licenses do expire, they'll then often partner up with companies that still have active licenses and mine as fast as possible in those sites. So that creates a very dangerous condition. Aung San Suu Kyi is right that the informal miners, the Yamasei, are often from impoverished communities who come to the jade mines of Pakhant and Kachin State to try to strike it rich. Unfortunately, that's a very rare occurrence, and more commonly, miners will get hooked on methamphetamine and other drugs and will not be able to survive the experience. The jade industry is a driver of conflict. There's no doubt about it, and the revenues that it earns to conflict actors are key in their ability to sustain their activities. So there's no doubt that there is a real link to conflict in jade.
Paul Donowitz, Myanmar campaign leader at Global Witness, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you miss something on The World this week? Well, you may never know unless you subscribe to The World's Latest Edition podcast. Take us with you wherever you go this weekend and stay current with all of our coverage. Find us in your favorite podcast app or at theworld.org/podcast. You're listening to The World. Anyone in Hong Kong thinking about speaking up against Chinese rule might want to think again. A new national security law went into effect this week.
My advice, of course, is to stay well away from it. Don't test the law simply because the consequences are going to be grave.
That story is coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. China moved quickly this week to implement a harsh new security law in Hong Kong. Critics say the law destroys the one country, two systems concept that Beijing agreed to in 1997. That's when Great Britain handed Hong Kong over to China. Free speech has long been a core value in the semi-autonomous territory. But as The World's Patrick Wynn reports, the new security law means there are now a lot of things you just can't say anymore in Hong Kong unless you want to risk going to prison.
Liberate Hong Kong, they're shouting. The revolution of our times. Everyone in Hong Kong has heard this. It's the go-to chant for this popular movement to, well, liberate Hong Kong, at least from Beijing's authoritarian rules. But wait, liberate Hong Kong, which is part of China, is saying that against the law? Here's Simon Young, a Hong Kong legal scholar.
If you use these terms, it might well be regarded as an intention to secede.
Yep, Hong Kong officials just put out a warning that said exactly that. And under this new security law imposed by China's Communist Party, getting found guilty of inciting secession is really bad. You could get hit with a minimum 3-year prison term. Worst case, if they think you're really plotting for independence, even peacefully, 10 years to life in prison.
This is rather shocking for us to see that our courts are going to have to, in very serious cases, order a minimum sentence of 10 years imprisonment, right? And their hands are bound regardless of the circumstances.
Here's how Hong Kong's Beijing-backed leader, Carrie Lam, describes the law.
The legislation aims to prevent, curb, and punish acts of secession, subversion of state power, terrorist activities, and collusion with foreign or external forces.
Okay, secession, terrorism, most countries try to stop that. But this new law, it's not really about stopping rebels with bombs. It targets people for having the wrong opinion. If the government decides you are inciting secession, Young says, you're in big trouble. Here's Carrie Lam again saying that the law will go after protesters who have
radicalized young people to desecrate and burn the national flag, vandalize the national emblem.
Okay, a couple of things here. Burning China's flag, they really hate that. And vandalizing the national anthem, that seems to mean something like this. Hong Kong protesters' dislike of China is so strong that they wrote this song, a Hong Kong anthem, which they sing instead of China's national anthem. Now, that may be punishable under this law. Again, here's attorney Simon Young.
Where you might get caught, of course, is incitement, right? You know, singing a song like that, is it capable of inciting someone to the committing the crime of secession?
Could be, he says. The problem is, you can say, I don't want secession, I just want free elections. But again, the final arbiter might be the Communist Party. They won't catch everyone, but it's risky.
Oh yeah. My advice, of course, is to stay well away from it. Don't test the law, simply because the consequences are going to be grave.
Now, a fringe group of protesters, they sometimes sing a different anthem.
And the rock casts red glare.
Does that amount to the crime of collusion with foreign powers? Possibly. Some Hong Kongers will drape themselves in U.S. flags and ask for support from U.S. politicians. And sometimes it works.
The law is a brutal, sweeping crackdown against the people of Hong Kong intended to destroy the freedoms they were promised.
But no matter what Nancy Pelosi says, Carrie Lam is making it clear that there's a red line. If Hong Kongers invite
foreign governments to interfere in Hong Kong's affairs or even to impose sanctions on Hong Kong, no central government could turn a blind eye to such threats to sovereignty.
Meaning, if you say, hey, America, please sanction China, they can definitely get you for that. Most of these national security crimes will be handled in Hong Kong by Hong Kong courts under guidance from Beijing. But if Chinese officials really don't like someone, they can decide to prosecute them in mainland China. Again, here's Simon Young.
Will someone just be arrested in the night and whisked away across the border in a matter of a couple of hours? We don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty there. That's why it's a bit scary.
Despite the new law, some Hong Kongers are still going out, protesting. Police arrested more than 400 people this week. Many Hong Kongers are frantically deleting tweets, deleting messages on their phone. And by the way, if you've gone online to say anything that might be construed as promoting Hong Kong independence, be careful about visiting. You also may have incited a Hong Konger to rise up.
If you tweet it, that is a message sent to the whole world, basically. And we know that this applies extraterritorially to anyone.
Anyone. The law is very clear that everyone on Earth is subject to it. And if you come to Hong Kong, you can face arrest too. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
In Ethiopia, the killing of popular musician Hachalu Hundessa has triggered widespread protests across the country this week. More than 80 people have died. Hundessa was a powerful political voice for the Oromo ethnic group. His death earlier this week is just the latest in nearly a year of troubling developments in Ethiopia and have become a rallying cry for the opposition to speak out against Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Adesu Lachetou is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and joins us from Washington. Let's start with the death of the singer Hachalu Hundessa. It's drawn the attention of the world to wider problems in Ethiopia. Why did Hundessa's killing spark such huge protests?
Hachalu was seen as a symbol of resistance against oppression among the Oromos, one of the largest ethnic groups in Ethiopia. So his death seems to have angered and frustrated a lot of people, and that has led to kind of clash between communities and with security forces. So his songs were very important in unifying the Oromo people during the protest that started in 2015, protests that actually helped bring in Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to office 3 years later in 2018. The songs became an anthem for the protesters, which helped galvanize the movement.
So that's interesting. The Oromo people actually had a big hand in bringing Abiy Ahmed to power. So what are their grievances today?
So the demands of the Oromo people are many. Some of them are shared by other Ethiopian people, and some others are not. One major point is an economic issue, which was actually the immediate cause of the protest in 2015. The Oromo live around Addis Ababa, and Addis Ababa was going through a radical transformation in the past few decades. A lot of Oromos were displaced by government projects, many without receiving sufficient compensation. But also political reasons are playing a role as well, because until very recently, political freedom was quite suppressed in Ethiopia. There was no representation. There was no open elections. Other non-Oromo ethnic groups were seen to be dominating the political landscape. And there are also historical reasons that created a sense of injustice that reinforced existing economic and political factors.
So in addition to Oromo people helping Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed be elected, Abiy Ahmed's father is also Oromo. So why hasn't the Prime Minister been able to address the concerns of these people?
Indeed, Abiy Ahmed identifies himself as an Oromo. He has been a part of an Oromo political party. So he probably tried to address some of the causes of concern among the Oromos. I can mention two reasons why he might not have been successful. One is that many of the reasons are actually very complex and time-taking. If you take a look at the issue of economic inequality, for example, creating inclusive policies and following them through takes a lot of time, but Abiy has been in power only for about 2 years. Secondly, there is also political polarization in the country. Some of the demands of the Oromos clash against the demands of other people. The Oromos demand greater representation and greater economic power in Addis Ababa, but people in Addis Ababa also fear against Oromo hegemony.
How is Abiy Ahmed's government reacting to the unrest this week?
Abiy has been reluctant about taking radical measures until very recently. But this time around, he has actually gone to the other extreme and taken very radical measures, including detaining major opposing politicians. And also, he has closed down a lot of TV channels, many of them run by opposition parties of different ethnic groups. He has shut off the internet. People are not able to communicate by Twitter, and that has cut off the diaspora from the local political voices. So these changes are more radical compared to the past, and it's a very controversial move.
Right, and that is a change that we've seen this past week, and we have to see it against the backdrop of other deeply entrenched problems in Ethiopia. If we go back to last fall, the international community celebrated the prime minister with the Nobel Peace Prize. And since then, an attempted coup, journalists arrested, the internet shut down repeatedly, and this week just the latest. And now this unrest with the singer popular with the Oromo people killed. I mean, just what's going on? Can you help us understand it?
I mean, Ethiopia is going through a very radical and tremendous political change. And if you remember at the time of Abiy coming to office, protests were still going on. A lot of displacement of people was happening. There was no stability. Many people also died in the process. So this, to me, looks like a continuation of that volatile change. And you can only hope that through political dialogue and openness and discussions, things will settle down.
Adesu Lachetou, Global Economy and Development Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
In Western China, nonstop surveillance and mass detention are still the norm for hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs. Beijing's crackdown on the Muslim ethnic minority began several years ago, but recent studies show that the Chinese government is also trying to systematically reduce the birth rates of its Uyghur population. How that's happening is through forced birth control and sterilization. In some areas with a high Uyghur population, birth rates dropped by more than 60% from 2015 to 2018. To give us some context is University of Michigan professor Alexandra Stern. She studies history, culture, and reproductive rights. What stands out to you in these reports coming from Xinjiang?
On the one hand, there are similarities with other instances of sterilization abuse and state-run campaigns for reproductive control. For example, there are similarities with the Fujimori-led sterilization campaigns in Peru in the late 20th century. And there are also resonances with the forced sterilizations that occurred in the United States as recently as 2010. What stands out, though, about what's happening with the Uyghurs is the multi-pronged reproductive control that the state is implementing, which encompasses forced abortions, sterilizations, IUDs, and other forms of birth control, all connected to what appears to be massive detainment and incarceration. So there's kind of multiple layers of human rights abuses.
Chinese government statistics, state documents, and interviews with detainees show that this is a carefully crafted campaign against Uyghurs. What's the scale of this?
The scale is monumental. I mean, in terms of both the broader history of forced sterilization and reproductive injustice, and in terms of being a campaign that has a strong component of Islamophobia and is part of a nation-building project, it's significant both internationally and also in the context of China, which has a long history of engaging in population control projects on its majority and minority populations.
You mentioned the various measures that are being used, like forced sterilizations and abortions. So what are the long-term health consequences of this on the people, obviously mostly women, who are subjected to it?
Unfortunately, I don't have much information on some of the clinical aftermaths of these procedures. However, we can say that it's very unlikely that any of these women are being tracked to look at post-operative outcomes or that they are being given anything, you know, that we would call systematic quality health care. So that's one issue, is that reproductive health always needs to be incorporated into broader holistic health. So that doesn't appear to be happening. And then finally, there is the mental health component of this, which is one of the aspects of sterilization abuse that I've studied in the U.S. context, where women who are forced to undergo sterilization experience, you know, a really unpleasant mixture of shame and regret and fear and anxiety. And I cannot but imagine that some of the women who've been subjected to this in northern China are in the same circumstances.
Generally, Alexandra, would you qualify reproductive control of a minority population genocide? And what would you say about it in this particular case?
Well, if we look at the international legal definition of genocide as an attempt to significantly reduce or stop the possibility of procreation of a particular population, then it does meet that criteria. This is a concerted effort to control and to reduce the population of a racial and religious minority in significant numbers.
Does the UN or the International Criminal Court have any authority over this?
I'm not sure what legal authority they have. In the past, similar instances of sterilization abuse have resulted in cases being brought to international courts, such as in the case of Peru, where a case was brought before the Inter-American Court. And I would suspect something similar is underway with reproductive rights advocates, international NGOs, and other entities that are representing this marginalized population in northern China. And certainly, this evidence will be really instrumental in building a case to demonstrate how extensive these abuses are.
Alexandra Stern studies history, culture, and reproductive rights at the University of Michigan. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
If you're feeling nostalgic about packing up, grabbing your passport, and traveling abroad, you're not alone. One of Taiwan's airports has an innovative remedy for what ails you. Songshan Airport in Taipei received 60 eager travelers on Thursday for a half-day fake travel experience. These intrepid day trippers showed up to check in. They went through passport control and security, taking selfies along the way, as you do. Then they boarded a China Airlines A330 passenger jet. Their destination? Nowhere. They just sat there on the tarmac, enjoyed the view of the jetway, and then deplaned. The people in this little group are the lucky ones, though. Close to 7,000 wannabe international travelers applied to take part in the trip to nowhere. The experience is being offered by the airport to show off the renovations and health prevention measures taken to protect travelers. Taiwan locked down its borders in March due to concerns over the coronavirus pandemic. It has reported fewer than 500 cases and 7 deaths. Domestic travel in Taiwan is booming right now. But for people craving international travel, 2 more groups of lucky winners will have their mock travel experience in the coming days. The Republic of Djibouti is easy to find on a map. Go to the northeast corner of Africa. It tucks into Ethiopia, right on the Gulf of Aden, facing the Arabian Peninsula. Djibouti is also a neighbor of Somalia and was once known as French Somaliland. The country got its independence from France 43 years ago. But only now in 2020 has a band in Djibouti recorded and released music for a global audience. If you know the music of the eastern corner of Africa, you may hear some similarities here. But the album points to a genre that is really its own thing, a sound Djiboutians can claim as their own. The album is called The Dancing Devils of Djibouti. Vic Sahoni co-produced the record. He's also the founder of Ostinato Records, the label that released it. Vic joins us from Bangkok. Thanks for being with us, Vic. So the first record ever to come out of Djibouti, really?
Yeah, that's actually the case, because if you look at Djibouti, it's a very young country, got its independence in 1977, and they've been governed largely by one party since, and that party believed, for various reasons, being a young country, that music should fall under the domain of the state. It should be a public good. And so from independence until now, it's really been only the government and the state and all the cultural state institutions that have financed, supported, and propped up music. And if you wanted to record music in Djibouti, there was only one studio you could do it, which was at the National Radio's studio. And the entirety of Djibouti's entire recorded output of music over these past 43 years is just sitting in the Djibouti National Radio Archives. It's never been packaged for commercial global release.
So just to be clear, The Dancing Devils of Djibouti, this is a new recording. This is not archive material.
No, it's not. They are a national band. They are the national radio band, but their primary job is to perform for dignitaries when they visit. You know, they perform when they're walking down the stairs when they arrive at the airport. They perform at presidential ceremonies, cultural holidays. They're very much the national band. They're an all-star band that is a mix of the best, older, legendary, very beloved musicians, as well as new young talent that they've been able to scout. But no, it's not an archival recording, although they draw greatly from the recordings that are sitting in that archive.
I got to say, for the first record ever from Djibouti, it's like an instant classic. It's just a wonderful group, great sound. I mean, they don't sound like a formal band playing at, you know, presidential ceremonies and stuff.
That's their on-duty job. That's their job that they're paid for. But, you know, when we came across them, they were just casually jamming when we came across them in 2016. And when we were introduced to them, they were introduced as the national ceremony band. And we were expecting something of a national anthem, chorus, or orchestra of something of that nature. But very quickly, we realized that when, you know, they're off duty, they're off work, and they're sitting and hanging around and jamming, they are not playing national ceremony music. They are doing what they do best, which is taking, you know, the essences of Djibouti's cosmopolitan musical sound and just reviving it, modernizing it, and adding their own lovely touch to it.
I mentioned in introducing you that the music of Djibouti is influenced by the music of neighboring Somalia, but there's a lot more to this music than Djibouti's neighbor, isn't there?
Yes, for sure. I mean, Djibouti, people have to understand, have been on, has historically been on a very strategic trade route. It's partially why the United States, amongst other big powers, have military bases there, because so much trade passes through Djibouti. And, you know, that trade has been going on for centuries, and cultures from Asia, from the Middle East, from elsewhere have all had to pass through there. If you want to move anything from Asia to Europe, you have to, or vice versa, you have to pass the strait that Djibouti sits on. So they've been influenced by a great deal of cultures, East and West. But also, you know, in their immediate independence era, when the national radio was, or still is, the sole broadcaster, there were three genres of music in particular that really inspired the band. And you can hear all of these. The guitarist who plays those offbeat licks, he was telling us how much he grew up listening to Jamaican reggae. The saxophonist, who is really the star of the band, he grew up on a steady diet of American jazz, and he would always point to the Harlem jazz era as this, you know, period of infatuation that he was, you know, that he studied and grew up with. And the singers, they spoke greatly about India's influence on Djibouti, the influence of Bollywood and the vocal styles of Bollywood that they would listen to, that they would learn from to be able to adapt and you know, diversify their vocal repertoire. So Djibouti might seem like a small country on the fringes, but for a very long time, it's really been at the center of so much cultural mixing and so much of, you know, so it's been so central to so much that's been happening in the world.
So Vic, with travel, tours, and things more or less at a standstill because of the pandemic, what is it like releasing a debut album with this kind of profile in the midst of a pandemic? And are we going to be hearing more music from Djibouti?
Yes, for sure. No, it's a sad tale because, you know, the idea was to release them and then have them touring, you know, by this summer. But of course, that's not possible anymore. I mean, we're still aiming for December. That might be optimistic. We hope things get better. We want more music from Djibouti to come out. You know, the government authorities who have been monitoring the release are very happy with the response. So, you know, everyone's behind more music coming out of the country. But there's more important things, I think, right now than touring. But I hope one day we're back to concerts and live shows and being shoulder to shoulder enjoying the music.
Yeah, I do too. Hope we can see the band live sometime in the near future. That'd be great. Vic Sahoni co-produced the new album, The Dancing Devils of Djibouti, by Group RTD. What great stuff. And that's going to do it as we kick off our July 4th weekend. How do we even know anymore if it's the weekend? Anyway, I'm turning the weekend into a vacation, so I'll see you all in a couple of weeks. Carol Hills will be with you in the meantime. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, stay strong. Thanks for making it here today.